I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Was it Barack Obama's fireside chat? Well, some critics are saying there weren't enough details in last night's presidential address. But on CNN, David Gergen called it the most ambitious to Congress in decades, saying it was half FDR fighting for the New Deal, half Lyndon Johnson pushing for the Great Society. Well, how was it received overseas, where economies are inextricably linked to ours? Let's start today with Andrew Walker. He's economics correspondent for the BBC. He joins us from London. Andrew, how are markets there reacting to the speech?
Well, you're right. It's certainly seen as being an ambitious agenda. I have to say, though, that markets were looking rather more at a different speech that we had yesterday, namely the remarks that the Federal Reserve Chairman, Ben Bernanke, made at the Senate Banking Committee, and in particular his suggestion that nationalisation of any banks is rather unlikely. That cheered markets significantly, certainly helped a little bit in Asia and in early European trading, although they subsequently turned down. So, you know, no question that people here and in the markets see the president's speech as an ambitious one, but their focus of their trading was elsewhere.
Well, let's talk about that, because that can be confusing for some people. Bernanke told the Senate committee, we don't need majority ownership to work with the banks. Taking them over more formally than the U.S. has would destroy their franchise value. Wall Street also seemed very soothed by that. But we hear from economic historian Neil Ferguson and the former Swedish finance minister who was on our program last week that some economists in Europe are puzzled that the U.S. hasn't taken more control of banks quicker, especially control with some stake in the banks.
Well, there are relatively small stakes in the banks by way of what are called preferred stock. But sure, I mean, in Britain, we've had some more dramatic moves. A couple of relatively small mortgage specialists, one called Northern Rock, one called Bradford and Bingley, have been fully nationalised. They were basically banks that were on the brink of complete failure. And a couple of other of the big high street names have got very large government shareholdings in them now. Royal Bank of Scotland, where the figure is over 50%. So the, you know, at 70%, the government has a clear majority stake. And another one called Lloyd HBOS, although it is less than majority control. So, you know, for sure, things have moved that bit further, at least in that one respect in the UK. I think perhaps the idea of nationalisation is, it's not popular here by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not quite the kind of political anathema that it is on your side of the Atlantic.
And why would markets overseas react favorably to Bernanke saying that they wouldn't go over a 50% stake in banks like, say, Citigroup, where right now there's the prospect of the U.S. government taking up to a 40% stake in Citigroup in return for more federal assistance? Why would markets find that good news, that there wouldn't be more of a stake?
I think because they do take the view that it's a problem taken very seriously by the Federal Reserve, by the federal government, and if they think they can fix it, in particular if the chairman of the Fed thinks it can be fixed without going to 50% or higher in major banks, then, you know, they see that as being good news in itself. I do think they probably believe that the government would be prepared to go over 50% if it did really seem to be necessary. So there's some comfort there. Also, the fact that it's just generally good news for people who have shareholdings in the banks themselves. You know, if it doesn't go over that 50% figure, it's correspondingly better for the stake they retain themselves. Their ownership of the bank is correspondingly less diluted than it has been in some cases here in Britain.
Right. Andrew Walker, just one last question. We note that Japan's markets seem to bump up a little bit today. Good news, because Japan's second largest economy in the world. They've been in turmoil. Japan's exports plunged about 50%. And we understand demand for Japanese cars is down nearly 70%. Just briefly, your thoughts on Japan's economy?
It does indicate, I have to say, that Japan, although it didn't make the same kind of mistakes, the banks there didn't make the same kind of mistakes that's happened in the Western world, they are very much exposed to problems in the rest of the world because of the strength of their manufacturing industry, and people cut back very quickly on manufactured goods when during a downturn, and their dependence on exports means that they are very much exposed to problems that originate elsewhere in the world. So Japan has done some things right, I think you have to say, but they are still terribly vulnerable to problems created elsewhere.
Well, it would seem that Japan, being the second largest buyer of U.S. bonds, the U.S. probably shouldn't expect Japan to help pay for our stimulus plan.
I guess that's right. I mean, yeah. Japan has been able to buy an awful lot of U.S. government bonds, partly because they've had a large trade surplus for many years. Well, actually, in the last few months, that surplus has turned into deficit. So the implication of that, the kind of economic arithmetic, is there's not so much money sloshing around in Japan for buying foreign financial assets.
Andrew Walker, economics correspondent for the BBC, speaking to us from London. Andrew, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, President Obama says his stimulus plan would save or create more than 3 million jobs, and it also includes money for those who've lost their jobs. But several Southern Republican governors are threatening to turn down part of the funds, they say, because accepting them would require their state to permanently increase the pool of people eligible for unemployment benefits. Right now, unemployment varies state to state. Many don't offer help for part-time employees or people in family crisis. And governors like South Carolina's Mark Sanford worry that in accepting benefits for those workers, he'd have to make those benefits permanent. He says he hasn't decided whether he'll take about $96 million in federal funds he believes come with strings attached. Meanwhile, South Carolina could use the money. The state is one of nine that's borrowed money from the federal government to keep its unemployment fund afloat. Remember, every state has an unemployment fund paid into by employers through a payroll tax. In South Carolina, the state fund was flush a few years ago, so the payroll tax was cut. But now the state unemployment rate has shot up. The fund is almost dry. Let's take a couple of looks at unemployment today. Let's start with Jerry Kirshner. He's a human resources manager at a steel plant in Hartsville, South Carolina. Jerry, we want to find out how unemployment issues affect you. So tell us, how has the recession, first of all, affected your business?
The current economic crisis we're in right now, and whether you want to blame tight credit, lack of capital orders, whatever, it's affected us about 40%. In other words, our order book is down around 40%.
Yeah, well, that's a lot. What steps do you take to keep your business going as your, you know, orders are down?
I have a real vested interest in trying to retain my workforce, and the last thing I want to do is get into what we term indefinite furloughs, meaning laying a whole bunch of heads. What I'm doing right now is utilizing one-week rolling layoffs. Specifically, that means I'll take a department and or a shift. They'll be off for 1 week. I can certify to the South Carolina Employment Security Commission through electronic filing that there is no work available, and therefore I will file for my employees electronically.
Well, now, as you well know, big brouhaha in your state over unemployment benefits, the governor accusing the Unemployment Commission of maybe not doing it accurately. He wants an investigation. He wants to see the data to see that people really are deserving of unemployment benefits. And there's talk of closing some loopholes that allow what, you know, some people say is gaming the system. Do you think that that's what you're doing by laying people off for a week and then bringing them back and laying them off for a week and bringing them back?
I do not. I specifically pay into our fund on a tax, you know, and I pay into what they call a reserve account. And when I lay off someone or I claim that there's no work available and they claim a week's worth of unemployment benefits, then it draws against my own reserves. That being said, once my claims experience rises, I will pay higher taxes.
And you're well aware of that. I mean, you think that's fair. Some people are saying, though, that what you're doing is a loophole and they're, you know, people in the state are talking about closing that.
I think where the perception of employers gaming the system are, historically, there will be some companies that will shut down, say, a week at Christmas and a week during the 4th of July, for example. And then they'll tell those people, well, then that's the time you go draw unemployment, therefore using those times as quote-unquote vacation pay for their employees during those 2 weeks down. My case is very much different. This is a rolling one-week layoff. I have people probably working 2 weeks out of three, where they're literally, because of the economic situation, no work available. And I feel that it is within my right, and I think a lot of employers do, that we can file unemployment for our employees, not gaming the system, but trying to retain our workforce. And understand that each employer will draw against their own reserves.
But then ultimately, what happens when a company's reserves run out? I mean, doesn't the state turn around and get more money from a federal reserve?
If I overdraw my reserves, obviously this pool, it's an aggregate pool. So while some companies are paying in, all right, and not drawing out as much, so they're paying in more than they're drawing, if my situation continues, I may be drawing out more than I have put in temporarily. At some point, my tax base rises. I'm still going to be paying back into that aggregate pool.
Well, and then the problem becomes companies that fail. Their people are taking out of the trust fund, but they're not paying in.
And that's a truly a case of something that could be termed the perfect storm. There's a lot of companies who go out of business. There was one recently in South Carolina of about 600 employees. So they're now not getting any revenue. The state's not getting any revenue from that company. However, all those people are drawing out. So you have less companies paying in, but more drawing out.
Well, how much do your workers get compared to what they get for salary from unemployment?
Right now, when I'm laying my employees off 1 out of 3 or sometimes 2 out of 4 weeks, they're already incurring anywhere from a 25 to a 35% pay cut. Okay? They're already suffering, and I know this. The unemployment helps. So while it is some replacement income, obviously it nowhere near comes up to what they're used to on a regular 40-hour week job.
Well, as we mentioned, your governor has said he might not take all of the unemployment funds the stimulus package is offering, but he's relented on one aspect. He now says he'll take the portion that would increase benefits to individuals by $25 a week. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but how much would $25 mean to your employees who are receiving benefits?
I think in several cases, anything would be welcome. A lot of the people, for years, we were enjoying as much overtime as you could work for the last 6 or 7 years. And I would hope that some of them, you know, put some away. But the truth of the matter is, some probably haven't, and they're suffering, and we're just all trying to get through this.
I want you to just weigh in briefly on the squabbling in the government in your state. Governor Mark Sanford accusing the Unemployment Commission of being at fault for the sudden, you know, disappearance of funds, that $800 million that the state had just years ago. The commission saying that they've been trying to alert the state that more and more unemployed people were taking more and more funds. Companies were closing. There was less revenue coming in, more people taking unemployment funds out. How do you feel about this battle going on?
I think it's simply a case of a lack of leadership on both sides. Nobody stepped forward and said, this fund is draining. Do we need to raise the tax rates? Do we need to change the disqualification system?
Disqualification. Do you think people were getting unemployment who should have been disqualified?
Well, I can say with most assuredly, in South Carolina, disqualified does not mean disqualified. Say, if I terminate someone for attendance, and I'm not talking about anything, you know, a family or sickness, you know, medical documentation precludes any of that kind of stuff. I'm talking about somebody who just doesn't want to come back to work. And I have to provide, you know, evidence of dates missed, progressive discipline, you know, in writing, copies of all this kind of stuff. I submit all my paperwork to the unemployment office. The hearing officer looks at it, and he may say, oh, okay, I'm going to take 8 weeks away from him. I'm still going to give him 18 weeks unemployment. So for a bad worker, he can still draw unemployment. I actually had a case last year on the second incident of substance abuse. An employee was terminated, but yet still was qualified to receive 12 weeks of unemployment off of me.
That's Jerry Kirshner, a human resources manager at a steel plant in Hartsville, South Carolina. Jerry, you've been very informative. Thanks you so much for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome. I enjoyed it.
Okay, we know. Many of you are saying, wait a minute, employers also win those unemployment benefit challenges. And research indicates that employers are challenging benefits claims more than ever. So when we come back, benefits denied. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. We're taking a look at unemployment, how it works and who does and often doesn't qualify. Now, if you're laid off, there's usually no question about unemployment benefits. But if you're fired or if you quit for what you feel is a good reason, your benefits may be challenged. And according to researchers at the Urban Institute who took a look at Labor Department numbers, more than a quarter of unemployment benefits are being challenged by employers, a record level in recent years. Joining us is Brian Flynn. He's senior staff attorney with Greater Boston Legal Services. He specializes in representing employed people at hearings where their former bosses contest their benefit claims. So I guess they'd be unemployed people. Brian, I think a lot of people who've never been involved with unemployment will be surprised to hear that you occasionally have to fight for it. The state does make the final call, but these days, how long does this dispute process take?
Well, and generally right now, because of the upsurge in unemployment, even uncontested claims can take several weeks. However, if a claim is contested, for example, just yesterday I had a hearing on a claimant who was separated from work in September September, and she is still waiting for unemployment benefits, even though she won the initial hearing saying it wasn't her fault for why she was fired. In fact, she actually is currently under eviction proceedings because of the long delay and still is not in receipt of benefits. And unfortunately, what we've been seeing increasingly is not only employers challenging cases, but challenging cases on rather frivolous grounds, cases that in my experience, I would say, there really is no doubt that the separation from work was for reasons that will legitimately entitle somebody to unemployment insurance.
Well, now you use a terrific phrase, separation from work. That's a wonderful euphemism for firing someone. What are some of the reasons that employers are giving in these hearings for not wanting their fired employees to get benefits?
One, I'll give you one good example, I think, of a client of mine who recently, and this is fairly typical, I think, she recently was let go of her job. She worked for a nonprofit for 12 years, and she actually had rave evaluations for all those years. And yet, several months before her termination, a new boss came in who basically said she wanted to clean the place out and bring her own people in. And during the time that she was out on family medical leave, she was sent a termination notice for not completing a report that wasn't even due yet. And that was a case where, because they challenged it and alleged that my client willfully disregarded an auditor filer a report, the person was basically, once again, because of how long it's taken these days, was without benefits for over 5 months. And at the hearing, the employer didn't even show up.
We're reading that employers give other reasons, that the employees were chronically late or didn't fill out projects in a timely way. But people can also quit. Now, if they quit, then the burden is on them to prove that they felt they had to quit. What are some of the reasons that employees give when they've quit for why they feel that they should get unemployment?
That's a very good question. When, and as you're right, if a person quits their job, the burden is on the claimant, the unemployed person, to prove that they are eligible for unemployment. Now, I have seen people who have had to quit jobs because they simply weren't paid wages for weeks. And I've seen employers contest those cases saying that, well, they were going to get around to paying them at some point. Other cases that we see, and again, unfortunately not too uncommon, is particularly women who face sexual harassment on the job.
And does the employee have to prove that there was this harassment?
The employee to prove that they've actually, yes.
Well, give us some other examples of clients you've had. I'm thinking of one that you mentioned who worked at a big department store for years and twice came into work late because his car broke down and he took public transportation. He was fired for those latenesses. Did he ultimately get unemployment benefits?
Yes. This was somebody who worked for 7 years as a retail salesperson. This company challenged his benefits on the basis that he broke a company rule, and that rule was that no employees could be late more than 2 times in 1 month.
And did he win?
And he won, but he was without benefits for several weeks because he was initially denied, and it wasn't until he got to a hearing where the review examiner agreed with my argument. Well, there may be a company rule, but as applied in this case, where a person basically was putting 2 hours every day to get there on a bus, that it was simply unreasonable for somebody 10 minutes late that he should be denied unemployment.
I'm just wondering, two last thoughts, Brian. First of all, do you understand how in this economy that employers have to ensure that the bad workers, the workers that they have a paper trail on, don't take from their limited unemployment pools?
Well, I guess I'm not questioning that there are bad workers out there, and I'm not questioning that some people might engage in activity that is actually would make them ineligible for unemployment. On the other hand, I do think it's important to remember that unemployment insurance is the first line of defense in a recessionary period. And the fact that somebody didn't work out perfectly as an employee doesn't mean they should be denied unemployment benefits.
Well, and many agree with you. They say that court rulings have slowly enlarged the definition of employee misconduct. And I'm wondering, too, if you might feel that the way the system is set up, employers have an incentive to put employees in a negative light, because if they can fire them without then having to pay unemployment, their payroll taxes, as we learned, then don't go up, and their pool of employment funds don't go down.
Yes, and that's especially true in the temp agency world, because temporary agencies hire numerous people, and so they have a real incentive to keep that down because they have so many employees on their books.
Brian Flynn, Senior Staff Attorney with Greater Boston Legal Services. Brian, thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
On this note, Associated Press is reporting that some former members of Congress are still out of work, so let's check in with them. Former Congressman Chris Shays of Connecticut, not working. Congressman Jim Himes, the man who beat him, is encouraging the Obama administration to appoint the Republican Shays to head the Peace Corps. Nick Lampson, a Texas Democrat who also lost re-election, is trying to form a nonprofit to help search for missing people. And Republican Thelma Drake of Virginia and former Senator John Sununu of New Hampshire are saying they're weighing their options. Still ahead today, animals using tools. Does it mean anything, or is a walking stick just a walking stick? Back after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Are you terrified every time you hear about job losses? Or do you say, well, this could be a good time to plan a new future? Researchers say how you answer those questions may be a little hardwired. We've long heard about assertive type A personalities and more mellow type B personalities. Now there may also be recession personalities. It sounds like pop psychology, but personality is a serious field of study. Our next guest coined the phrase type T and says President Obama seems to be one. What does that mean when it comes to the bad economy? What type you are? Well, Dr. Frank Farley is a psychologist at Temple University in Philadelphia. He joins us from the studios of WRTI at Temple. Thanks so much.
Delighted to be here.
And tell us, first of all, what is type T?
Well, the T stands for thrill, and it reflects risk-taking, thrill-seeking, excitement-seeking, stimulation-seeking, arousal-seeking sort of personality.
Well, now, you really think that President Obama might be one? Because people have said he's so even-keeled.
Well, you know, maybe they'll end up being a type O personality because he does have some very, it seems to me, kind of unique, unclassifiable characteristics. But the type T, and by the way, there's lots of other scholars have got similar kinds of concepts, but I talk about there being T mental and T physical. And so the T mental is where you're expressing it more in psychological ways, mental ways, etc. The T physical is where you're expressing this personality more in the physical realm, like climbing Mount Everest.
I'm guessing that you're saying that Obama might be the T mental, you know,
yes,
calmly taking on what other people would run from, which is one of the worst, you know, economic situations, things like that.
Yes, indeed.
Well, one of the ways you assess someone's personality type is through a test. Tell us a few of the things on the test, you know, questions or statements that people have to respond to.
I don't like my opinions being challenged.
All right.
Well, a T-type thrives on challenge, so they don't mind their opinions being challenged.
Okay.
I would rather be an accountant than a TV anchor. Well, a T-type would prefer the TV anchor. I believe that I control my destiny. T-types tend to believe that they control their fate. They're very self-confident. They believe that they're in charge of their destiny. Type A, by the way, is differs on certain things like anger. They're extremely competitive to the point of being almost combative with others. And one of the things about the T-types, on the other hand, is they often are competing with themselves, you know, setting very high standards for themselves rather than worrying so much about competing with others.
Huh. So we have a taste of the T and of the A, and we know the more mellow B. What type of personality is best at handling a tanking economy? It sounds as if the T would be right up there.
I think so, yes. Some of the things about the T are they often are creative, inventive. They thrive on uncertainty and the unknown and the unpredictable. They have high energy levels. As I mentioned earlier, they tend to believe they control their fate. So you package all those things together, and this is probably a very high survival person during economic bad times. You know, they can see new ways to survive. They may change, if they get laid off, they may just create a whole new line of work for themselves. So they can actually rise to that kind of challenge and not be terrorized by the uncertainty of it all.
Well, what do you say to people who say, oh, this is a bunch of hooey, you know, typing people? Because, for instance, I'm a perfectly confident T until I'm out of work for months, you know, and then surprise, I'm a little more pessimistic, you know, that people aren't as much creating their reality, you know, because of their type, but they're just reflecting it.
Well, most personality factors seem to have a significant genetic component. The estimates vary, but anywhere from 40 to 60% is often the range for a whole set of personality factors.
Huh.
So, in a sense, these people can sort of deal with the environment better than because of their personality. But the environment can also become a factor. And so anybody who gets unemployed for a long period of time is probably going to get a fairly high level of stress and despondency. But my guess is that the big T, the T types, will be able to survive better.
Well, and that brings up a very, very serious note. We have the benefit of a professor of educational psychology, so I do want to ask you, you know, you can have some fun with personality types, but we're reading of people who have been totally overwhelmed. There have been stories of entire families wiped out by someone who'd lost a job and had huge debts. In those stories, are we moving out of, you know, personality and into something else? I mean, if someone's really feeling really overwhelmed right now, what can they do?
Well, you know, some of these are extreme cases, but they attract a lot of attention, and that's not the normal way that people deal with stress of this type. But some of the ways are to keep perspective, keep your balance. That's important in all phases of our life. This will pass, and it's not the end of the world, so don't jump out of a 10th floor window.
Don't make it the end of the world, right?
Exactly right. And share your concerns, your thoughts, your feelings with loved ones. We're a social animal. Don't keep it inside and get it out and talk with friends and loved ones about it.
Okay, so some advice there for people who are struggling. And we also want to note that you've also given advice to the military, in that case, on what kind of people are most effective in fighting terrorism. So this idea of personality research is something people are paying attention to.
Yes, I was asked to spend a day with the generals and the colonels in the Army. They were interested in sort of risk-taking and thrill-seeking personalities and how that might tie in with, you know, the evolving Army and the whole new face of war. And, of course, the new face of war is terrorism, and it's not the old set-piece wars of the past. And so there's high uncertainty, unpredictability. Combatants have to be able to think quickly on their feet, be innovative, be relatively fearless, be willing to take risks. And by the way, it was quite interesting. The Special Forces, I talked with one of the leaders in Special Forces, and he was telling me that this is one of the things they look for. You know, they don't use the kind of tests that, you know, psychologists might use, but they put recruits through certain training schemes and so on, and at the end, they know that they've got the right kind of person for special ops, and that kind of person often looks like a T-type. Again, T-types are creative, inventive. They tend to be fearless. They can think on their feet.
And this is the physical T-type, too, I'm guessing.
Well, more the physical T-type, too, but when you're engaging an enemy, that's you don't even know who the enemy is sometimes. And there's so much complexity in modern warfare, and it's often right in your face. It's not, you know, being separated by a few hundred yards. It's right in your face. Often there's a mental side as well. You know, you got to be able to process information very quickly, be able to connect things quickly, make a decision, and take a risk as needed.
Thank you, Dr. Farley. Frank Farley is a psychologist and professor at Temple University. Well, in a few minutes, a possible cause for cancer. But this note tomorrow, a move to put more money into early stage detection rather than late stage cures for cancer. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, last night, President Obama said that with funding, there would be a cure for cancer. But he also pledged to reform education, introducing a young girl who'd written a letter to lawmakers asking for help with her school, saying, "We are not quitters." Well, a group of philanthropists determined to keep young girls from quitting has created a school for low-income girls in New Bedford, Massachusetts, where 40% of students drop out of high school and only 10% of adults have a college degree. Our sister school is a new tuition-free private middle school for just 30 girls who spend over 11 hours a day in classes, including required tutoring. Lisa Yates is executive director. Lisa, the school's name comes from New Bedford's storied maritime history, we understand.
Yes, it does. Captains would often take their wives out on sailing voyages, both packet ships along the coast and then whalers that would go out for 3 or 4 years at a time. These women got to experience the world, learn about things and experience things that women from their hometown never had the opportunity to do.
And they were called what?
They were called the Sister Sailors.
Yeah.
And so our sister school is named for those Sister Sailors in the hopes that we'll provide the same kind of journey for our girls.
Well, and it's a journey without boys. The thing being that this will mean fewer distractions for the girls. But we've talked on this program with critics of same-gender schools, and lawyers with the American Civil Liberties Union, for instance, have said kids need to learn to work with students of different religions, race, and gender.
I think they have this opportunity at adolescence to really focus on themselves and on their academics. In particular, that developmental period is fraught with trying to fit in socially, trying to develop a peer group, figuring out relationships with boys, when the girls are really developmentally too young to be able to make informed and mature decisions about it. Delaying that level of interaction for a few years and allowing them to build that confidence will only provide them with advantages as they move into high school and secondary school programs that are co-ed. One of my favorite things about our sister school is that our top student is a girl. Our best mathematician is a girl. Our number one athlete is a girl. You know, every hand that goes up in our math class is female. And providing an opportunity where girls are pushed to take those leadership roles will provide them with the confidence once they're in a co-ed setting.
Well, the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education says that single-sex classes within co-ed schools have jumped from 3 in 95 to more than 300 now. And in the past 12 years, more than 80 full-fledged single-sex schools have been created, yours among them. But another criticism is that single-sex schools play into stereotypes. The boys are going to be aggressive and they're going to need more work in things like literature and reading and writing. And the girls are going to be passive. And do you almost reinforce that by having an expectation of it enough that you want to form a school to address it?
I don't think so. I don't think we reinforce the stereotypes. I think, if anything, we push the girls and create opportunities for them to step outside them. They're not playing off themselves with boys in the classroom. They're able to create their own identities completely separate from their gender.
Well, the girls are being challenged. You've had some react to report cards by saying, "Wow, these are the lowest grades I've ever gotten, but this is the best I've ever felt." And you received a holiday card?
It was my favorite card this year. One of the students sent a holiday card, you know, "Dear Miss Yates, happy holidays." And it was signed from the next executive director of our sister's school. I told her she could start her internship whenever she's ready.
Yeah. Well, it does sound as if the girls have been inspired. But right now you have just 30 girls in 5th and 6th grade. We know the goal is to expand to 7th and 8th graders to have 60 students in all. But could you have a larger effect if, instead of focusing all these private donations on one select group, you put all this effort and money into the general public school population in this fishing town that's been so hard hit lately?
Well, I think, you know, New Bedford is always on the cusp. And what a lot of the international nonprofits do when they go in to do work in a community, economic development in particular, is they go in and they educate the women, and the women raise the village. So in a way, our school, our investment in New Bedford's young women is our long-range investment in the future of the community, knowing that our girls are already giving back to the community through their service, and that more educated women raise more educated children. So future generations of New Bedford natives should also start out on the right path as well.
Lisa Yates, executive director of our sister school in New Bedford, Massachusetts, Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, still to come before we go today, that new study on cancer and alcohol. It's got doctors paying attention, and we'll call up Dr. Tim Johnson in 1 minute here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. Did you hear about that new study that says even a single glass of wine, beer, or liquor a day can increase the risk of some cancers in women? What? What happened to a glass of red wine a day staves off heart disease? Researchers at Oxford University surveyed over 1 million British women, then tracked their health for 7 years. They found the risk for cancer of the breast, liver, and rectum was elevated among women who drank. And the more they drank, the higher the risk. Let's check in with Dr. Timothy Johnson, medical editor for ABC News and Here and Now. Dr. Tim, what do you think of this?
Well, it's a study that everybody is paying attention to because it is so large, actually 1.2 million women. Well done for an observational study, and it's definitely stirred the water. The problem, as you indicate, is that there has been previous research, also observational research, which has shown that a drink a day seems to lower the risk for heart disease. Now, I could bore you with all kinds of arguments both ways, but I'd say from the experts that I've already talked to, they're more impressed with this study than some of the previous ones, and so they're being increasingly cautious about the idea of women drinking for their health. Yeah. And they also point out that there are other good ways to try to lower the risk for heart disease besides drinking a glass of wine. In other words, watching your diet, exercise, keeping your cholesterol down, et cetera.
Yeah, well, some people might be saying, but that's not as much fun as a glass of wine is to them. And I know this is a serious subject. Why is it that, drinking alcohol might increase the risk of cancer?
We honestly don't know what the mechanism would be in all cases, except that in the case of breast cancer, we know that it increases levels of estrogen, which are a risk hazard for breast cancer. So there's a possible, plausible explanation in the case of cancer. But what we're looking at here are so-called observational numbers. They tie the two together. They don't explain in all cases why.
Right. And well, the study also found that moderate drinkers, women, actually had a lower risk of thyroid cancer or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So it's really a mixed message.
It is definitely a mixed message, and it's not only got women mixed up, but I tell you, all of us, too, who try to report on it. I would say this as a sort of bottom line. If a woman is truly drinking no more than a glass a day and has no problems with the drinking or any other side effects, I don't think she should be scared out of doing that. On the other hand, I don't think anybody would say to women who don't drink, you better start now for your health. There's too high a risk of dangers from alcohol and alcoholism. And the proof for that is not that solid.
Well, and it would seem, too, if you have a history of particularly breast cancer in your family, you might want to take this into consideration.
I think you raise a very important point. Another way to approach this is to look at family history. If you have a history of cancer, that'd be a reason not to drink. If you have a strong history of heart disease, might be a little minor reason to do it.
Dr. Timothy Johnson, medical editor for ABC News and Here and Now. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
What makes humans different from other animals? Well, until the mid-20th century, many people thought the essential difference was that humans used tools. But that idea was shattered in 1960 when famed primate biologist Jane Goodall observed wild chimpanzees using sticks to collect termites out of their mounds. Since that discovery, biologists have found many other animals that use tools. And Brandon Keim, science writer for Wired.com, joins us to talk about them. Hello, Brandon.
Hi, Robin.
You write about some pretty striking uses, and the pictures are extraordinary. We'll have them at our website, here-now.org. But let's just start with the Egyptian vulture.
Well, the Egyptian vulture enjoys eating ostrich eggs, which are large and hard and difficult to get into, and so it takes a rock in its beak and smashes it against the egg and opens it up that way.
Well, staying with birds, there are different types that use sticks, and they use them to forage for insects, the woodpecker finch, the green jay, the New Caledonian crow. Tell us about the Caledonian crow.
That seems to be the one that is the most conscious about its tool use. And a bit of background for this, of course, is that there's some debate over whether or not, you know, when an animal is using a tool, is it actually consciously using a tool in the way that, you know, we look in our toolbox and pick out a wrench or the right size screwdriver or what have you? Or is it just some sort of, you know, some sort of instinctive behavior, some program that's running in their head and pop, there it is.
Is there an answer to that or is that the unanswered question?
I'd say that's one of the big questions, and in many cases, it is unanswered. There was actually a very interesting study that was done recently on a population of capuchin monkeys in Brazil, where these monkeys have been observed using rocks to crack open nuts. And what the researchers are wondering is, are they really consciously going about selecting their tools? And so they presented the monkeys with stones that looked the same, but one was denser and stronger than the other and better suited for cracking nuts. And what would happen is a monkey would go to the stones, and if it picked up the heavy, dense, good tool first, it would use that one. But if it picked up the light stone, the one that was more liable to break itself, then it would put it back down most of the time and go over and pick up the good stone and use that instead. What that showed is that the monkeys really were consciously picking a tool that was suited for the job.
Well, and let's go back to the Caledonia crow, which not only uses tools, but makes them. Explain.
There was a very interesting experiment that was run with them in which food was put inside this jointed tube, and the only way that a crow could knock this food out and be able to eat it was to take a piece of wire that it was given and actually shape that wire into the correct configuration that it could then insert into the tube and knock the food out. And so that step, that shaping, makes the behavior seem pretty intelligent.
Right.
I think that's the only, that's really, that's.
And the bird hadn't seen any other bird do this? It wasn't mimicking anything?
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. Huh. It was improvising.
Well, you write about a group of dolphins in Australia that put sponges on their noses while hunting. Why is that, by the way?
It enables them to stir up the bottom, to stir up the seafloor, the sediment, and, you know, the sand scatters around and prey gets flushed out and then confused in the sand cloud, and the dolphins can eat them. Part of, I think, what's really interesting about that is that it seems that this behavior is actually localized in that bay in the Indian Ocean and among that, you know, extended family of dolphins. So it's quite possible that one dolphin figured this out, and I think the name that researchers have given her sort of unfortunately is Sponging Eve. and then, you know, either other dolphins in the vicinity sort of picked it up by watching her, or she taught her offspring, or however it happened.
Well, you know, and I'm looking at a series of pictures that you have of a gorilla using a walking stick to cross a body of water, you know, seeming to poke around to see where it gets deep, and then using this walking stick to keep its balance as it walks across. It's hard not to anthropomorphize, you know, not to think, that looks human. That is a gorilla that's thinking, you know, about how it's going to get across this body of water. And I know that when Jane Goodall's mentor, anthropologist Louis Leakey, learned of her discovery of chimpanzees using tools, he said, now we must either redefine man, redefine tool, or accept chimpanzees as human. Obviously, that didn't happen, you know, after Goodall's discovery. But what do all of these discoveries mean?
I think that rather than asking the question, should we consider, you know, this animal to be a person, we can just as easily say, well, are people animals? And of course we are animals. And so I think that the questions about tool use, that they don't say, okay, well, you know, now we should consider animals to be human, but rather we should see this behavior as something that exists in a whole range of life here on Earth. And we're part of that range, and so are gorillas, and so are mole rats, and so are Egyptian vultures, and all these other creatures.
That's Brandon Keim, science writer for Wired.com. You can get to his article on animals using tools, complete with these terrific pictures, at our website, here-now.org. Brandon, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And this was really all a roundabout way of allowing us to play Pink Floyd's Several Species of Small Furry Animals Gathered Together in a Cave and Grooving with a Pict. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.